What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson, and today is a special kind of one-off episode. Recently, I was on a panel called What About Whataboutism at Australian National University, and it was really, really good. It was policy relevant, but it drew on a kind of scholarly understanding or a social science understanding of when it makes sense to do comparisons. And the specific context and my specific remarks are very much focused on China, the Uyghurs, Xinjiang, right? America's history with genocide, with oppression, and like, when does it make sense to point to comparisons to understand things? When is it legitimate? When is it, you know, propagandistic or serving overtly political purposes? So my remarks kick in around the 31-minute mark or so, maybe 32 minutes. And the whole thing is really great. The whole second half is a pretty vibrant discussion. I think you'll enjoy it. And next episode, I'm going to have some kind of big news about the pod. Some changes are afoot. I think you will like it. So stay tuned. Enjoy this and see you next time. Peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, everybody and everyone. My name's Greg Raymond. I'm a lecturer here at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs. And I'm the convener of the Global China Research Spoke under the auspices of the Centre for the China in the World. And the task of the Global China Research Spoke is to look at China's impact globally, particularly at the grassroots level. Today, we're doing something a little bit different and looking at a kind of ethical issue. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we're meeting on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. I'd like to also acknowledge the support of the Center for China in the World and the support of the Coral Bell School for putting on this event today. So the topic is what aboutism? And that's quite a mouthful, but we're going to try and unpack the perils and the benefits of comparison, particularly with regards to making ethical judgments about the behavior of countries in the economic in the global system. So it was the American sociologist Seymour Lipset who once said, to know only one country is to know no countries. And his point there is that we need to compare in order to acquire knowledge. But what about when we move to making, ethical judgments or judgments about whether or not certain actions are particularly reprehensible or just mildly or so forth? And when we think about Lipset's injunction, does that mean we should also compare actions like China's illegal territorial claims in the South China Sea with Israel's, as far as I know, equally illegal claims in Gaza and the West Bank? Should we compare Australia's immigration detention policies, which have quite devastating effects, with China's hideous detention of Uyghurs? Is it legitimate to compare China's theft of international property with Australia's intelligence operations in East Timor, as we know occurred during the Timor Gap and oil and gas treaty negotiations? So we know that we gain knowledge for comparison, but do we gain a sense of where we are ethically? There are other axioms that we can turn to, and we all know many of these, or at least we do in the West, sayings such as people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And then speaking of stones, if people are familiar, and many of us will be familiar with the Christian Gospels, there's a parable there where Jesus of Nazareth happens upon a woman who's being stoned to death for some infidelity. And he makes the intervention by saying, let they who are without sin throw the first stone. And then we have sayings that are simple, like two wrongs don't make a right. Where do we come to when we consider all these different sort of ethical principles that we use in everyday life? Some of them seem to attribute equivalence to wrongdoing and both the actors and their accusers, And so they seem to appear to call for restraint for responding in responding to infractions of what is good. But on the other hand, when we think of something like two wrongs don't make a right, it seems to be like that the second wrong must be judged on its own merits. It can't be allowed to go unremarked or unopposed simply because there were wrongs preceding it. So we have these different ethical imperatives, one calling for restraint, the other refusing moral relativity to present recognition of what is wrong. So these sort of two poles, these two principles seem to be in tension but also complementary. But are we getting ahead of ourselves if we even think about applying these sorts of principles in the world of international politics? Of course, the international relations realist view says that national interest is the only motivating force in international politics, and the Machiavellian principles of political conduct would seem to permit immoral acts in pursuit of power, perhaps sometimes in pursuit of larger goods like peace, stability, and prosperity. Moreover, if we bring in these moral and ethical codes, are we discussing universal moral and ethical codes, or are they rooted in particular cultural and historical contexts, such as the post-Enlightenment West? So, big questions. It's very lucky I'm joined by our panel of eminent and talented speakers today. Let me introduce, we have Professor Ian Hall, who's a professor in international relations and the acting director of the Griffith Asia Institute at Griffith University. And he's also an academic fellow of the Australian India Institute and currently co-editor for a little bit longer, I think, of the Australian Journal of International Affairs. We also have Yun Jiang, who's the inaugural Australian Institute for International Affairs China Matters Fellow. And prior to this, she was also the co-founder and editor of the blog China Nikan and is currently managing editor of the China Story blog at the Australian Centre for China and the World.
And former
managing editor. Thanks, Yun. And we have also with us today Van Jackson, who's a political scientist, former Pentagon specialist who specializes in Asia-Pacific security, the politics of US foreign policy, and theory and practice of grand strategy. He's currently a senior lecturer in international relations at the Windy and Chilly Victoria University of Wellington and a number of other titles. So welcome to Ian, Yun, and Van, and we're going to begin with some individual statements, some individual contributions on the topic today of whataboutism, and we're going to run first with Ian, then Yun, and then Van, and then we'll come back for some Q&A first from me, and then with everybody who's joined us today. So I think that's over to you, Ian.
Brilliant. Thanks, Greg. And thanks so much for the invitation to talk about this. So this, you know, this is a really important and interesting topic. And, you know, whataboutism is absolutely everywhere, especially for those of us who spend too much time on Twitter and other kinds of social media platforms. So, look, I'm going to risk being really kind of pompous and high minded. This has given me an opportunity to go back to my roots as an international theorist rather than a sort of India specialist, is what I work on now. So look, whataboutism is a really familiar technique. All of us who have children know about whataboutism, but you do it too, or he did it too, or she did it too, is a pretty common line that you hear from kids a lot. It's also something, it's a technique, a technique of argument that the rhetoricians for hundreds of years have deplored and disparaged. And it's a, you know, as you rightly said, the argument that two wrongs don't make a right is a familiar one to all of us. But whataboutism, what is it then? It's a way of deflecting criticism and it's disarming critics. And it's very effective despite being crude. But I think it's also very corrosive to political life and public debate. And for those reasons, it's used by authoritarian elites to defend their positions, their power and their ill-gotten wealth. The problem with whataboutism, though, is that it has intuitive appeal, especially for those of us, as you rightly pointed out in your opening comments. It's got intuitive appeal for those of us who are brought up in a kind of Christian or post-Christian understandings of morality. So as you pointed out, you know, Jesus comes across the woman being accused of adultery and then says, let he who's without sin cast the first stone, or words to that effect. And St. John's Gospel relates that those who heard it, being convicted by their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest, even to the last. And Jesus was left alone and the woman standing there in the midst. Now, Jesus wasn't saying you're all hypocrites. Rather, what he was trying to make a more general point, that we're all sinners, or at least potential sinners, that we're all guilty of something, or of potentially guilty of something. Now, that point is fine from a theological point of view, but I think it was also, at the time and now, it's politically dangerous. So it's good to be modest, it's good to be humble, it's good to be self-aware, it's good to be aware that we all make mistakes, or that we might be prone to cupidity and so on. But it has. But if we take that too far, especially in our public life, that causes problems. So the Romans didn't like this idea that we're all sinners, and for some good and some bad reasons. It, as Nietzsche pointed out, Jesus' ideas directly challenged Roman ideas about virtue, manliness, heroism, all the things that we think that made Roman men rather unpleasant, but which they cherished. But Jesus' teachings also challenged the Roman state, or to be more precise, the Roman understanding of public life, which emphasizes participation in the exercise of judgment. And this tension was brought into focus, of course, by the sack of Rome by Alaric in 410. So apologies, I said this was going to be a pompous talk, so it is going to be pompous. St. Augustine tells us in City of God that many Romans blamed the Christians and blamed Christianity for making the empire weak. They castigated Christian ethics, not just the injunction to judge not and to prioritize eternal salvation over worldly things, but also Jesus's advice to turn the other cheek, his pacifism. So, and it, of course, the pacifism combined with the view that everyone is a sinner and we should look to our own salvation led the early Christians to avoiding military service, deprecating war, but also avoiding public life in Rome. And the Romans, many pagan Romans, thought that this had weakened Rome itself, allowing it to be overrun by the Goths. Now, Augustine's response to all of these critics was really, really important in City of God. And here I'm getting back to the point about whataboutism, okay? Because it's Augustine's response, it addresses precisely this question. So what Augustine does in City of God is say, we have to reconcile Roman conceptions of public life, because we need to have some kind of order and some kind of justice, some sort of rudiments of those things to just for our own well-being. But also we have an obligation to try and reconcile that somehow with Christian ethics. So famously and controversially, of course, Augustine tries to come up with an account of when war and killing might be just and when Christians might serve as soldiers. But he also says that Christians ought to care about res publica, the public thing. You can't just ignore it and just sit and wait in the catacombs for the second coming and resurrection, which is what a lot of the Christians did. You actually have to participate in public life and make an effort. So he said, yes, stakes are bad, right? They are products of greed and violence, of ugly, nasty men often, and that governments are often dominated by the greedy and the violent. And the history of the Roman Empire, as he relates, illustrates this really well. Yes, Augustine writes, what are kingdoms but gangs of criminals on a large scale? What are criminal gangs but petty kingdoms? Looked at one way, the difference is only in scale. They're both organizations created to build power and seize wealth. And then Augustine tells a story. It's about Alexander the Great. Alexander captures a pirate and he asks him what he thinks he's doing. And the pirate replies, the same as you, threatening people and seizing other people's hard-earned cash. But because you do it with a tiny craft, says the pirate, I'm called a pirate. And because you have a mighty navy, you're called an emperor. Now, Augustine doesn't recall Alexander's response to this, but Augustine makes his own. Says what distinguishes government from piracy is justice, which has to be done and seen to be done. It isn't always done well, and it isn't always done properly, but it's never going to be perfect. But Augustine insists that peoples and rulers have to strive for it. Christians have to play a part in trying to define what it is. They have to participate in public life and try and make some sort of imperfect justice work in the here and now, and they have an obligation to do that. So that even if you reject all of these Christian ethics, even if you reject Augustine's argument, there are still some good reasons, I think, to take these arguments seriously. Because and here, again, apologies for the pomposity. So if, as Orwell made very clear, being fatalistic, throwing our hands up in despair, being a realist, opting out of politics, all of those things are as a direct route to the establishment and maintenance of tyranny and exploitation. And aspiring tyrants and pirates know that fully well. This was one of the core messages of 1984, a book that wasn't really an attack on communism, but on the kinds of they're all as bad as each other thinking, the kind of realism that we saw in the 1930s and 40s. The kind of ideas that were pushed by people like James Burnham, that famous sort of ex-Trotskyite who became a hardcore realist and then neoconservative later on, and that flourishes today. So Orwell attacks the familiar but pernicious idea that there's always an elite that exploits us. There is an iron law of oligarchy, as Burnham termed it, and a concept that Orwell appropriates. There's always an elite that's going to rule over and exploit the masses. The new boss will always be just as bad as the old. He pointed out, Orwell pointed out too, the object of propaganda is not to get people to believe in something, but rather to disbelieve and distrust everything, even when it was obvious and right in front of you. The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command, is the line that we all know from 1984. It's not money or armies or secret police that ensures that oligarchs, the self-interested, the self-aggrandizing, dominate and exploit us. It's rather apathy, fatalism, and disaffection. So whataboutism plays a really important role in bringing about that sort of situation. In what old-fashioned academics used to call the collective demoralization of the masses. So few, if any, contemporary tyrants or aspiring tyrants have any kind of alternative worldview to which to inspire their followers or justify their actions. Instead, when they're criticized, what they do is point to the past or present crimes as a critic. So China's responses to Western critiques of its actions with the Uyghurs, the classics of this genre, point to the concentration camps, and Beijing points back at Guantanamo, suggests genocide, and Beijing queries the fate of Native Americans. The message isn't just people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. It runs much deeper and nastier. It's this: when you had power, you killed and you maimed and exploited. Now we have power and you can't criticize us for doing the same thing. So if we want a colonial empire, we'll have one. If we want to assert our ideological or racial superiority, we will do it. It is our time, and it's your time to shut up, stop resisting, and accept our domination, or else. So whataboutism isn't sort of smart or cute or charming, not that it's particularly charming in five-year-olds either, but it's not particularly cute or smart or charming. It's intentionally destructive and it's demoralizing. It attempts at creating the ideal circumstances for tyranny and exploitation, which is why tyrants are really keen on it and why they promote it. So none of this is to say that we shouldn't be frank or honest or about our own present or past conduct. We shouldn't condone hypocrisy. We shouldn't pretend that we're prone to avarice, that we're not prone to avarice. We should do all of those things. But just as importantly, we can do those things without throwing our hands in the air, declaring that everything is corrupt, declaring that the strong will just do whatever they wish whenever they want to do it, and there's nothing we can do about it. So we can do those things, all those good things, without indulging in whataboutism. Here, let me go back to Orwell, and then me, because I'm still being pompous. Orwell was surely right. Murder is just murder, regardless of who does it. Whether they're left, they're right, they're American or Chinese. It doesn't matter, it's still murder. We can surely be sufficiently sophisticated that murders can't be excused on the grounds that others have committed similar crimes recently or in the distant past. So thanks, Greg. You've given me a great opportunity, not just to be pompous, but to rant for 10 minutes. And I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. I'm so glad we've given you a chance to go back to your roots, because that was a tour de force. May I now introduce Jung to make some comments on the topic of whataboutism?
Thank you, Greg. And thank you, Ian, as well for I guess a philosophical and theological overlook of whataboutism. Of course, there's also similar parables, I believe, in Taoism as well. But I know that we have people in the audience who are much more equipped than me to talk about these issues. So I am also on the unceded land of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, because I am near ANU in Canberra as well. My focus of the talk is slightly different. It's not about, the focus is not really on government, but on researchers, scholars, individuals when they deploy whataboutism. So, what about so-and-so? I think it's a tactic that is used across different political spectrums. So it's not just used by authoritarian countries, or it's used by a lot of people with different political backgrounds and leanings. In case of a Chinese government, a well-known example, you know, one point out China's human rights records in places such as Xinjiang, the Chinese government likes to respond with, oh, what about racism and gun violence in the United States? That's a pretty common one from the Chinese government. And on an individual level, for people such as myself, and when I say people such as myself, I'm talking particularly about Chinese Australians. When we point out some of the negative experiences we have experienced in Australia, including about racism, there are people who then respond with, well, what about China? There's racism in China too. In both cases, as Ian has pointed out, whataboutism is used to deflect any criticisms. I think the logic behind that is that you should not criticize the action of a government if your government is also bad. What your government is, what the people who make this statement perceive what your government is. So it seems to stem from this attitude that you must pick a team. It's either your team or my team. And if your team has done some wrong things, then you cannot criticize anyone else. So in the first example I talked about, someone who perhaps is a bit sympathetic towards the Chinese government's actions may believe that the other person is on the team USA, and therefore they can never admit that the USA government has done anything wrong. And in the second example, the person who perhaps don't want to talk about racism in Australia may believe that the other person is on Team China, and therefore they would not criticize anything about China. So those people who use whataboutism to deflect criticism, they appear to believe that it's not possible to be consistent on principles. That is, it's not possible for either both countries to be wrong or both countries to be right, and that governments should just naturally do better anyway. Instead, the whataboutism, what encourages, I think, is a race to the bottom. What it's saying is that wrongful actions by one particular party then justifies wrongful actions by all parties. But instead, if we think about like this, whataboutism can be used positively as well. It's not necessarily a negative thing. It is negative when it's used to deflect criticisms. But we can use it positively by saying, well, what about other countries that's doing better things than us? We should do them as well. That has also happened throughout history in governments. For example, in self-strengthening movement and other movements in other countries, where countries look to other countries that are more advanced than them and say, well, what about those countries that's doing better? Perhaps we should learn from them. So this attitude of learning from others is the positive side of whataboutism. So coming back to scholars and researchers and people like perhaps people in the audience, people like that tend to think comparatively, I think. So they compare and contrast the similarities and differences between countries. And I think that is a good thing to do when thinking about issues. It allows us to see the big picture, the systematic problems that we would otherwise miss if we focus only on one country. So if we only focus on oppression of Muslims in China, then we miss how that can be linked to the wider issues of colonialism and the anti-terrorism discourse that's come on in the West. So by thinking and comparing and contrast, we can then see a big picture. But of course, things like the existence of Guantanamo Bay does not justify China's policies in Xinjiang or vice versa. It's not used as a way to, it should not be used as a way to justify wrongful actions, but as a way to see the big picture. And on things like technological surveillance and censorship, a lot of discussion has been focused only on China, but we know that even democracies use a lot of similar tactics and use similar technologies for surveillance purposes. Again, democracies using these technologies and tactics should not be used to justify China's actions or vice versa. But it is to see that the issue is bigger than just China. If we see Xinjiang, you know, oppression against Muslims or technology or censorship as purely issues unique to China, then there is a that we could be misled into thinking that, well, clearly the only way to solve this problem is to just get rid of the Chinese government. And then everything will be better. The world will be a better place. And we should all just hold hands and dance in circles. But that's not true. There are a lot of other issues involved we need to think deeply. And what it also does is that it casts the Chinese government as uniquely evil while absorbing the actions of other governments as well. So that is the downside of only focusing on one government and not the, I guess, the world as a analysis. The solution to whataboutism, I think, as I mentioned before, is that one, it is okay to acknowledge that more than one party can be wrong. I think that should be a very simple thing to do for most people, unless you're very ultra-nationalist and who believes that whatever your government is doing is always right and other government is always wrong. I think most people here can probably acknowledge that no, governments can be wrong. Even our government can be wrong. And one government doing wrong does not justify other governments doing the wrong thing either. And we should all strive to do better, rather than race to the bottom, which is what whataboutism enables. I want to briefly talk a little bit about a related question of whether it is possible to be consistent about values and about human rights. Do we care more about human rights in, say, China than other countries? So there are a few arguments about why we may be more, we should be more concerned about human rights in China than elsewhere. For one, China is a big and powerful country. So what does has more influence on the world than the smaller countries? For example, maybe Saudi Arabia. What it does maybe have a smaller influence on the world. There's also an argument that China is an authoritarian country and we should be more concerned about bad behaviors by authoritarian countries than bad behaviors by democracies. I think that comes from the sense that even if US used foreign interference to control the politics in other countries, at least it's democracy. And the outcome will be less bad than if China was used foreign interference to control other countries. But I don't really buy that argument because it seems to be a case that we expect higher standard behavior from authoritarian countries than democracies, which I think is probably not something we should be doing. If anything, we should expect a better standard behavior from liberal democracies, if not equal standard behavior. But the fact of the matter is, right now, a lot of countries see China as an adversary, so they are more willing to criticize China than to criticize other countries that are geopolitical allies. So here you can see that I think, realism, hard power politics does play a big role in determining whether countries criticize other countries' human rights or values.
Thank you so much, Ewan. That's a great set of points. And I think you're spot on in saying that morality is used in accordance with certain sets of interest judgments. And that's certainly a valid observation. Now, can I turn to you, Van, and hear what things look like from across the Tasman Strait?
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. This is it's an unusual conversation, but one that's unusual in a good way. I mean, obviously, whataboutism is about comparison. And the question is, what kinds of comparisons are reasonable and relevant to make? And in that context, I just want to make two points, and then I'll unpack what I mean by each. The first is that analysis and critique, it does political work, even when it presents as not doing political work, right? The second point is that if you criticize China in a manner that is ahistorical or that doesn't permit comparisons, your analysis is going to suffer. Like, what you think and what you have to say will be distorted. So on the first point, analysis does political work. If you're a consumer of analysis or a consumer of expert opinions, everyone here obviously is, it's important to be sensitive to the political implications of the information that you're absorbing, right? And by that, I kind of mean you have to ask the question, qui bono, like, whose agenda does this critique or analysis benefit, right? And you have to ask that question not as a way of invalidating the information, but as a way of conditioning how you understand what's happening, right? Why that information is even coming at you, right? And there's the good example is, you know, Xinjiang in China, right? There's a ton of evidence that China's engaged in what both reasonable and unreasonable people would call a cultural genocide in Xinjiang. And that evidence exists no matter how it's presented, right? But whether we label it a genocide, A, that's its own debate. And then B, you know, the meaning of the evidence itself is completely up for grabs, right? The so what, or the okay, what do we do? That's up for framing. So in the context of a conversation about Uyghur genocide, I've had people say to me, like, yeah, well, the US government genocided the Native American population 200 years ago. And okay, true enough, like, that's not incorrect, but it's decontextualized information for one, and two, it doesn't change what's happening now in Xinjiang, right? So why would you bring up that kind of comparison? Well, that's what we would call a tanky or a campist view, right? A tanky brings up a comparison like that, the double standard critique, to serve a notionally anti-imperial political project that cares only about taking down American imperialism and not anyone else's imperialism, right? And, you know, mercifully, tankies are rare, except on Twitter. But the opposite problem is actually way more common, right? If you're a pundit or a politician making a lot of noise about genocide in Xinjiang, right? On the surface, it's because you're outraged at the injustice, right? And for some people, that's all it is, okay? But that also, that accusation also happens to be one piece of a narrative puzzle that reactionaries and neo-fascists have been assembling to advance a clash of civilizations political project in the West, right? One of the ways you know that's what they're doing is because it's the same people in the national security state during the Trump years who were consolidating political power by presenting China as a supervillain, who were also literally supporting Chinese oppression of the Uyghurs during the War on Terror years, right? So if Uyghur human rights is the true motivation of the reactionaries, then they wouldn't have been complicit in violating Uyghur human rights the entire first decade of the 21st century, man, you know? So the US helped China build a surveillance state in Xinjiang, and then it's outrageous only now? Like, no. So the standard of drawing relevant, reasonable comparisons makes visible the politics of analysis here, right? Is comparing Uyghur genocide to what the US did over 100 years ago, is that a relevant and reasonable comparison? It depends on how you do it and what you're trying to accomplish, but not really, right? The entire world system was different then, right? But even if you can make a case for why it's a relevant comparison, the political purpose that's going on there is not reasonable, right? Why? Because whitewashing cultural genocide is not a legitimate purpose, right? That's not okay now. And then on the other side, is it relevant and reasonable to compare how a given class of people evaluate Chinese human rights violations now compared to how they evaluated it, you know, 10 to 15 years ago? And like, obviously, yes, obviously, right? It's relevant because it's the same political and social milieu, right? Some of the exact same people, Mike Pompeo, right? It holds constant across comparisons the thing that we're analyzing, which is Chinese treatment of Uyghurs. And then, you know, maybe most important, it's the same reactionary project across time. Great power rivalry is an evolution from the war on terror. It was going to happen before the war on terror sidetracked us, right? So going from one construct to the other is a consistent story of militarism at the expense of democracy. And you cannot tell that story unless you can make that comparison, right? So having said all that, my point is just that it's really important to be sensitive to the political implications of analysis, because being conscious about the politics of critique makes you more measured, less hyperbolic, more nuanced, right? And that brings me to my second point, which very briefly is that if you view China in a presentist, ahistorical, decontextualized way, you're going to end up with bad analysis overall. Like Greg started out this panel with a quote from Seymour Lipset, which was on the money, right? Comparison, if it's relevant and reasonable, gives our judgments a sense of proportionality and potentially validity. You know, it's a check against both threat inflation and threat deflation. So you take the example of like the PLA Navy or PLA Air Force routinely violates the ADIZ, the Air Defense Identification Zones of Japan and Taiwan, right? That sounds menacing, you know, but as it happens, countries violate each other's ADIZs sometimes, right? The US does it sometimes. And an ADIZ violation has not ever triggered a war, knock on wood, right? So the fact of ADIZ incursions without authorization is not so weird, right? It's certainly not something to be afraid of. But the frequency of the PLA ADIZ incursions is, you know, if not unsettling, it's at least begging for an explanation, because it's abnormal, right? And it's been escalating for the past decade. But if you just decontextualize what's happening there, the ADIZ violations, it's very easy, and the media does do this, to paint a picture that makes it look like China's about to launch an aerial invasion of Taiwan every day, right? Just any minute now, it's going to happen, right? Similarly, the past couple years, there's been a huge threat discourse buildup around China seeking a sphere of influence in Asia and the Pacific that directly challenges this abstract thing we call the rules-based order. Why? Because spheres of influence are built out of practices of control and exclusion that circumscribe sovereignty. On paper, at least, rules-based order is supposed to preserve sovereignty, right? So there's a conflict there. Now, there's a strong case to be made that China is doing this. I've made that case myself, actually, or they're trying to build a sphere of influence, right? And I have kind of a problem with that, because I have a principled objection to sphere of influence arrangements. Your mileage may vary. But my enthusiasm for fear-mongering about a Chinese sphere of influence and getting freaked out about it, it's tempered by the fact that I'm an expert at spheres of influence. I have comparative knowledge of the subject, right? And I know that the US maintains a sphere of influence in the Pacific that it doesn't acknowledge. It has a formal, official, very real sphere of influence that allows for the US to exclusionarily control the national security fate of Guam, American Samoa, Palau, the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Marshall Flippin Islands by treaty And that's only just the official sphere of influence. Informal spheres of influence is like a whole other conversation, right? So the sphere of influence construct cannot be as menacing as some of us say if we're fighting to preserve one ourselves in the Pacific. There's something else going on there, right? So comparison is what allows you to test whether you're applying principles consistently, right? Because if you're not, then you're misestimating both the nature of the problem that you think you're facing and what ought to be done about it, you know? So all I'm saying is, like, be aware of the politics of analysis and be aware that any analyst or a pundit that uses whataboutism to deflect comparison or to decontextualize information, they run a high risk of distorting the very thing that they're trying to talk about or promote. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Vin. That's a really terrific set of points. And I think it's absolutely spot on to say that without comparison, things can seem much more menacing. And I think that somehow is a kind of rebuttal to seeing whataboutism as a unadulterated ill. Perhaps it has some benefits. Now, I want to turn to asking the panelists some individual questions. And I want to begin with Ian, and just a question about whether or not we have some institutional blinkers on making comparisons. And here I'm thinking about Australia, the fact that we're in a very close alliance with the United States, and whether or not that means that we can't do the sorts of comparisons and whether or not this is a good thing. And I would cite that in 2016, the former chief of the Australian Defence Force, Angus Houston, said about ANZUS that we should begin by cutting the talk about recalibrating the alliance. And he seemed to be saying that we can't undertake critical interrogation of the alliance. So when we're in an alliance, does this constrain governments and their bureaucracies from conducting honest appraisals or comparisons of international conduct? Would welcome your thoughts on that question, Ian.
Thanks, Craig. That's a really interesting question. Maybe I could, if you don't mind, maybe just move the frame slightly outwards in all of this. We frequently pick up on, I think in sort of public discourse about foreign policy, it's often commented upon that, you know, Australia might criticize country X, but not criticize country Y and country Z and so on. And then, and you know, in one sense, that's kind of a, you might say, well, it's a cheap shot, or that, you know, we might then conclude that Australia will criticize the weak, but not the strong, or there might be some other kind of motive going on there. But we do need to acknowledge, I think, pretty clearly that in foreign policy, we don't necessarily call out everybody all the time for things that they do. So we can have a legitimate debate about the appropriateness or otherwise of a foreign minister's statement on, I don't know, something like the January 6th incidents in the United States. Or, you know, should the Australian Foreign Ministry have commented on that, called for calm, you know, argue for an orderly transition of government? You know, there was a debate around the time precisely about that. And that's where we kind of, I think, as a country, as governments do get themselves into some trouble, in the sense that, you know, we don't necessarily have very clear guidelines or very clear principles involved in, you know, in the countries, in the incidents that we will call out and the incidents that we won't call out and the context in which that those sorts of things happen. And it's into that space then, that's one of the spaces in which whataboutery tends to start to flourish, and in which accusations of hypocrisy in particular become very prominent. And so I don't really have a very clear answer to your question, but I will absolutely acknowledge that there's a deep difficulty here, you know, in terms of, you know, when do we speak out publicly on something and when do we not? And I speak here from sort of personal experience. You know, I work on India. Some things that happen in India are not good politically, morally, in terms of the people, and so on. Would I like the Australian government to speak on some of those issues? Yes, sometimes I would. Would it be helpful for them to speak on every issue? Probably not. But then we're getting into the murky area of which principles are we applying and which are we not?
Yeah, thanks, Ian. I think it is a tough question. I think sometimes it is very contextual. And in Thailand, they have a saying called Gala Tesa, which basically means you've got to choose the timing and the place for any particular communication. So perhaps that's something which is relevant here. Yuen, can I turn to you? And I want to ask you, we hear a lot about the Chinese Communist Party. Well, we've heard a lot more in recent years. We didn't hear it for all of the Howard era because we were making lots of money in Australia. But suddenly, after 2016, things changed and we heard a lot more about the Chinese Communist Party. Now, we know that in the Xi era, that a very interesting apparatus in the Chinese Communist Party, the United Front Work Department, has become re-energized. And it has a very, political goal. This department, the UFWD, it aims at rallying all those who can be rallied, uniting with all of those who can be united as a way of isolating Chinese Communist Party enemies. So how do we take into account in some ways that China's United Front work is advantaged by people who ask the sorts of what about questions that we're asking today? Many scholars of China assess that China would like to split Australia away from its alliance with the United States. So does this mean that if we're objective, if we're too even-handed, we're actually risking assisting China's goals and risking, becoming useful idiots in doing party work? I invite your response.
What an excellent, excellent question. It actually goes to really the heart of what does it mean to be an academic scholar or researcher or think tank analyst? What role should they play in public discourse, in influencing the government? So they are. What am I talking about here? Are people who don't work in the government? People who work in government being a different category. So people, scholars and researchers, the people here, people in the audience. What sort of role should they play? Is it to advance a particular country's national interest? So, for example, should the role of an academic scholar to advance Australia's national interest, no matter whether. I mean, in Australian universities, we have academics from all around the world. Not all academics are even Australians. So do we expect all Australian academics to advance Australia's national interest, or do we not? Similarly, the question can be posed for think tank analysts as well. And then even one from that, even if that was the case, even if the case was to advance the national interest of a particular country, who gets to define what is Australia's national interest? And if it's a government day, then is the role of the academic scholar or researcher or think tank analyst to advance Australian government's priorities? No, the answer is very simple. When I was in the government, the answer was very simple. When you're in the government, your job is to advance the government's priorities. So what the government priorities, however they define it, your role is to make it happen, to advance it. But now I'm outside the government, and that is a bit more difficult question to answer. Is your job to advance Australia's national interest or to provide objective, even-handed analysis? To me, I think for most people, the role should be the latter. It should be to provide objective analysis that can then in the result, maybe to inform policy, but that should not be the top priority for researchers. Of course, if you're working in an institution, an organization, there's always funding issues, right? How you get funding for your research, whether it's through government grant or through another country, that can then resulting in the influencing the direction of your research, even if not the outcome, but the direction of the research. So that is the issue we have to grapple with as an open country, as a democracy. In authoritarian countries, that's probably not an issue you really need to think a lot about, because, you know, especially as you mentioned, under Xi's China, which is increasingly authoritarian, academic freedom is being increasingly restricted. And the Chinese government does expect these scholars to serve the country and serve the party. But I would hope in Australia's case, and I think it is different, we should not be expecting the same from our scholars. This means then that there will be people. There will always be people, what other people will call parroting CCP's line or singing from CCP's songbook. But that does not necessarily mean they're wrong. Just because they happen to agree with a particular government's policies or stance or rhetoric does not necessarily mean that they must be then wrong. The Chinese government probably say a lot of little things. I mean, if they say the sky is blue, it doesn't mean the sky isn't necessarily not blue, you know, for example. So, and in another case, when we talk about, especially about whataboutism, you know, when the CCP criticized racism or imperialism in Western countries, that does not mean that we should then immediately stop criticizing racism or imperialism just because they may support CCP's cause. To always oppose whatever the CCP's, the Chinese Communist Party supports, that is very reactive. It basically means then the Chinese government and the Communist Party sets agenda and you just have to always oppose it. I think that's a very reactive thing. Instead, we should think about what is our priorities and for people in government, what is our national interest.
Thank you, Yun. I think it comes back to that question of do principles exist apart from political agendas? All right. Van, and can I turn to you? And I want to lift a quote from a review of a book that you recently wrote. And in this book review, you wrote the following. Unless our response to China centers our political values, we risk aligning our actions with those who oppose democracy, be it China or the reactionary forces in our midst. I'm just wondering if you can explain a bit more about what you meant when you wrote this and what it implies for a comparative approach to international politics.
So if at bottom the principle that we claim to defend ties back to human freedom, right, however you want to phrase that or cash that out, then we cannot violate and compromise and trade away human freedom in order to smite our enemy, right? The ends justifies the means, that cliche is a cliche, right? And it masks the truth. And the truth is that the ends is fuzzy, opaque bullshit most of the time. And the means expose what we actually value regardless of what we say. So the Communist Party of China is a problem, in my view, and as an analyst, right? And as a political partisan too, I guess. It's a problem because of its ethno-nationalism, because of its role propagating oligarchy, because it facilitates human oppression, which is even going beyond its own borders, right? And so the solution to that cannot be for us to engage in various forms of human oppression in kind, okay? It cannot be giving unchecked power to the national security surveillance state. It cannot be lining up with dictators and neo-fascists and kleptocrats across Asia. It cannot be stoking racist violence at home and abroad, right? The solution cannot be enlisting Five Eyes in a clash of civilizations that pays off for fascists and rich people and nobody else, man. Mm-hmm. And so what I was getting at in the book review, I got a little heated there, was about China's relations in the Pacific in that moment where the context that I was writing it in. And what I was trying to say was that, like, centering in our statecraft, in our foreign policy, a principle of human freedom or democracy, or even just least harm, is the only way that I can see to guard against us being a threat to human freedom. And I'm reading that very explicitly off, like it's one giant book review version of a subtweet of the Trump administration in that moment, because they were using great power competition to aggregate political power on behalf of a very anti-liberal, anti-democratic milieu in the United States, right? So it's like they're using things about the regime in China that are true, then they're amplifying it, and then they're selling it around everywhere, and they're using that to basically become fascists, right? So if the fascism, if for lack of a better phrase, is the thing that you sort of worry about with China, becoming that yourself is what's the point of all this, right? So that's what I mean by like centering our political values.
And I think if I interpret you correctly, you're saying let's not do what was done in the Cold War, where authoritarian governments were very much supported, as long as they were our authoritarian governments. But this leads me to a very sort of similar question about these sorts of reactions to China's defects and the aspects which we need to oppose about China, and what it does to the countries that are doing the opposing, and whether or not we can preserve freedom and values. And so, Ian, I want to ask you, you know, in Australia, the China debate, of course, as we all know, has been quite heated and poisonous at times. And some Chinese Australians have started to feel, victimized about that. The question is, are we in Australia in a time where we can still talk about the relative merits and flaws of all great powers? Or are we in danger of sliding into a public discourse where asking these questions is to risk being labelled disloyal? Are we heading, do you think, to a more dichotomous world of you're either for us or against us? Or have we still got middle ground and still time to sort of debate these questions? Clearly we are today, so thankfully that future is not upon us, but is it getting closer?
I think we have to have, this is partly a scale issue, okay? So in relatively small countries, there are kind of incentives for everybody to try to rub along as best they can, and you end up with sometimes a consensus emerging, which is not necessarily always particularly healthy. The bigger the country, the bigger the debates, the bigger the resources are for either side or all sides to draw on. Sometimes it becomes a little less kind of bloodthirsty and nasty, and it's because it's not a zero-sum game anymore. Australia's kind of in that sort of strange zone where it's not quite big enough and it's not quite small enough to have really serious and healthy debates about these kinds of topics. But I think it really needs to. I think the question of how to respond to China, China's behavior in the region and so on, let's face it, has been actually quite helpful to Australia in lots of ways. I mean, even when we are accused, for example, even when the light of global times is shone upon our own colonial genocides and so on, I think that's a healthy and good thing. It means that we have to face up to the fact that what went on in the 19th century and into the 20th century and what goes on today in terms of our treatment of Indigenous peoples, it has to be answered. There has to be a public answer given for what has occurred and what is occurring in Australia. And I think that's a healthy and good and positive thing. So, you know, whataboutery in that sense can actually produce some good, positive and strong outcomes. I recognize though that the discussions that we've had are bruising and they will continue to be bruising. But I think in the end, you know, I'm sorry to like, as we started, well, you actually started, I'll point the finger at you with Jesus coming across the woman accused of adultery and so on. I still think though that we've got to try and love the sinner and hate the sin. if people are presenting bad arguments, we need to point out their bad arguments. That doesn't mean to say that that person presenting that bad argument is a bad person. We can still recognize them for what they are, which is often the case, a really well-respected, solid, strong, well-informed scholar or analyst or whatever else that person is. If they put a bad argument, I think we have an obligation to point out it's a bad argument. And I think that advances things. I don't think that's something which necessarily poisons the atmosphere or shuts down debates and so on.
Perfect. It sort of reminds me of something I heard the Archbishop of Canterbury say yesterday, since we were talking about Christians. He said, we have to learn to disagree well. And I think that's true. Disagreeing well is important. Can I thank you, Ian, for great contributions, Van, for giving us a very fresh perspective, and you for giving us some really excellent points. And thanks, everyone, for listening in and for bearing with us despite our problems with the right Zoom address, which I'm glad to see that we got it all right and everyone participated in this conversation, which I think is an important one. So thank you all, and we'll make this available as a recording in case you want to hear any of it later. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, Greg. Bye-bye. Thank you.
See you.